This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, early voting is underway in the primary for Milwaukee's mayoral race. We'll talk about how the candidates stack up with one another and where they fall on a couple key issues for the city. Now, here's a kitchen situation you might have experienced. It's the end of the day or end of the week, and you haven't planned anything special for dinner. You don't want to turn to delivery or carry out. You're at a loss. But wait, the freezer. The past version of you did the current version of you a big favor and prepared a couple freezer meals. You pop one in the microwave for a few minutes or the stove for a while, and boom, it's dinner. On this edition of Food Friday, our guest has lots of advice for great food for the freezer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a go-to meal that you like to make and freeze for your own future, or maybe to give to somebody who needs that little something? What things do you like to make and then freeze? Are you new to the concept? Do you have questions about what to make and how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron Clark is creator of WellPlated.com and author of The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
You are a big fan of cooking with freezing in mind. Why is that a big part of your cooking arsenal?
You know, as much as I love to cook, let's be honest, sometimes it can kind of be a pain or you just don't have time. And the thing about dinner is that it happens every single night. And so whenever I am cooking, it is just as easy to make a little bit more. And then I love stashing the leftovers away in the freezer for busy nights to come.
Now, how many meals do you reckon you have in the freezer at any given time?
Well, I would say I probably have about 2 to 3 different meals. It's just my husband and I, but we both work from home, so that kind of keeps us going for both lunch and dinner. And then I also love to keep a handful of staple freezer ingredients on hand for if I need to whip up a quick meal. So, for example, I'll always have a bag of stir-fry vegetables in my freezer so that if I need to whip up a quick stir-fry, I don't have to deal with chopping a bunch of vegetables. I can just reach in and grab one of those, that kind of thing.
How about organizing in the freezer? Mine can be kind of, you know, a difficult place to navigate sometimes. Any advice on keeping track and keeping things clear in there?
Definitely. So, I mean, yes, a freezer can be kind of an interactive game of Tetris, choose your own adventure. Two big tips that I have are to think about grouping things into sections. So I know for my own freezer, we have a drawer style one. So anything that is meat related, I always put to the left of the freezer so that, you know, if I'm looking for some meat to thaw for dinner, I don't need to upend the whole freezer. I just know, hey, like, did I throw those chicken thighs in there or not? I know there's just one place in the freezer I have to look. And if they're not there, I don't have them. And then I usually will say, oh, hey, I forgot I had that ground hamburger. Surprise. Here we go. And then, you know, so just however that kind of works for you. My other big tip is to label things. It's like one of those things that you're just tired, you're cleaning up dinner, you're like, no, I don't want to do this. It does not need to be fancy. Just, you know, if you have something wrapped in foil, just get out a Sharpie, write roughly like what it is and the date. I can't even tell you how many times I've reached into my freezer for something. I think like, oh, well, this is only like 3 weeks old, it'll be fine. And then it's like, just kidding. I'm pretty sure that this is from winter of, you know, 2020 or whenever, however the heck long it's been back there. So our memories are not very good for that. So just take that minute, write it on, you know, I just wrap things usually in aluminum foil, pop them in a zip top bag, and then I'll write what it is on the foil so then I can reuse the zip top bag afterwards.
That saves me a lot of freezer archaeology once I finally learned the hard way that I had to label stuff. Now, how about you also make the case for thinking in portions, not just putting in a huge amount of food X, but the way you're actually going to serve it, freezing it that way.
Exactly. So you just have to think about what makes sense for your family. So for my family, you know, it's my husband and I. So if I'm making a big pot of beef stew and say we want to have half of it for meals the next couple days, and then I want to save the half it for meals to come, rather than freezing, you know, don't freeze. Or if you're instead of making, so you really want to get into the freezer and you want to make 2 pots of soup instead of one, you know, if you are a smaller household, do not freeze all of your soup in one batch, because it's going to take forever to thaw. And then you're going to be in a situation where you have leftovers and you're wanting to put it back into the freezer. And I do not recommend refreezing things. So if you could just kind of take that step ahead. As a bonus, it's much easier to find space for smaller containers than it is for larger containers. So you'll be doing yourself a favor and making it easier to organize your freezer too.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Aaron Clark, creator of WellPlated.com, author of the Well-Plated Cookbook. We're talking about great meals to make with freezing in mind. You make a double batch, say, eat some now, put some in the freezer for the future. Do you cook this way? What are some of your favorite things? Maybe some advice you have? Or do you have a question about how to make and freeze different kinds of foods? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aaron, you've shared a few recipes with us. One, we've got a full recipe up. We've got a couple links also at WPR.org/Food Friday. Here's one I'm excited about. Frozen breakfast sandwiches that we make and then freeze. I wouldn't have even thought of doing this. Talk about the basics that go into making your frozen breakfast sandwiches.
Definitely. So the inspiration for these were a certain drive-through with Golden Arches, which is still a guilty pleasure breakfast of mine, but they have these delicious English muffin breakfast sandwiches. And I kind of wanted to come up with a way to make those myself from scratch. And then I ended up combining that with, you know, that style of sandwich is really popular in the frozen food section at the grocery store. And I thought, okay, well, why would I stop for fast food, or why would I buy something with a lot of processed ingredients from the freezer section when I can just make it myself? It's a lot healthier and a lot less expensive. So this recipe comes from my cookbook, the Well-Plated Cookbook. And the great thing about it is that it is so super versatile. So you bake actually eggs in a 9 by 13 inch pan. They come out in a sheet, and then you can cut them, either you can stamp them out into rounds or just use a knife to cut them into squares. You assemble them with, you know, cheese, bacon, whatever you want, right on the English muffin. You can wrap it whole and pop it into the freezer. Then on a busy morning to come, rather than, you know, reaching for a donut or grabbing fast food on the way to work, just knowing that you have that in the freezer, you can pull it right out and reheat it directly from frozen. It is so delicious. And especially this time of year, just having a fresh, warm breakfast can really set your day off on the right note. And it's a really healthy way to begin your day, too.
Now, here's a sign of how dumb I am, Aaron. I read this recipe and was like, are cooked eggs going to freeze okay? Then a few minutes later, I thought, the number one thing I make with freezing in mind is quiche, which is eggs. And
yes.
They come out fine.
Yes.
So the eggs you bake and put on these sandwiches, they freeze, they come out, and they're good and eggy?
They are great. I mean, no one will know that you have, that this was previously frozen. It's really pretty fantastic. I recommend microwaving them on a paper. The biggest issue isn't actually the eggs. It's keeping the English muffins from getting soggy. So I recommend microwaving it on wrapped in a paper towel, and that paper towel will absorb the moisture and keep it off your bread. But eggs, actually, cooked eggs freeze like a dream. You can even freeze raw eggs, as long as you can either scramble them first. And for example, pour them in a mini muffin tin and then just like freeze them, you know, in portions that way. If you happen to have a lot of eggs, the only two things you can't freeze, you cannot freeze the egg in the shell, and don't freeze hard boiled eggs. They taste terrible. I tried, it does not go well, but scrambled eggs are fantastic frozen. And quiche. Quiche is another one of my absolute freezer favorites.
So we're going to call her now at 800-642-1234. Philip is with us in Milwaukee. Philip, hi.
Yes, I would like to know how long one can keep shrimp and fish in the freezer.
Now, Philip, are you talking like stuff you bought frozen or whatever, you haven't cooked it yet? Or are you talking about you cooked a meal with shrimp or fish in it, now you're freezing it?
No, just frozen.
Okay. Philip, thanks for the call. I don't know if you have the that kind of information in front of you, Aaron. We're mostly talking about the cooked meals today, but any thoughts for Philip?
Definitely. So my general rule of thumb is just when in doubt, I say about 3 months. You know, if the fish is, if you have wrapped it really tightly and, you know, you froze it right when the thing with raw ingredients is you want to freeze them when they are at their peak of freshness. The idea of the freezer is to save something at its peak of freshness to enjoy at a later time or help you with meal planning. What you don't want to do is take a fish that's been sitting in your refrigerator for like 4 days. Oops, I didn't get around to cooking it, and then throw it in the freezer, because it's not going to be any better when it comes out. The freezer is not like, does not magically transform your food. But if you wrap it really air, once the fish is in your freezer, assuming you froze it fresh, your biggest enemy at that point really is just frost building up on it more than it is, you know, like if you can freeze, like if you can freeze bacteria in the sense that if something is cooked and you let it sit out and you throw it in the freezer won't kill the bacteria. But if you keep it off there to begin with, it's not going to magically appear in the freezer. So the idea is just to keep the frost off of it. And I generally find that 3 months works for just about anything, including fish. Fish, because it's a little more sensitive, you might want to look to about a month. But I would say generally meat, stews, casseroles, 3 months is good with that. And then things like pie crust, I've gone up to 6 months. Or, I mean, I once found a homemade pie crust that was a year old, I'm going to say it. And homemade pie crust is a lot of work. So I just went ahead and baked it and didn't say anything, and it was fine.
Great.
So it's really just kind of looking for the freezer burn. And then once you thaw, like, give it a sniff, make sure it still smells nice and fresh.
Philip, thanks for the call. We're talking to Aaron Clark, creator of the wellplated.com website, author of the book Well Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. It's Food Friday. Aaron's with us to talk about some of her favorite recipes to freeze and then reheat later. For a lot of convenience, you could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a meal freezing question for our guest or a favorite go-to that you like to maybe cook extra and freeze some for later. Call in at 800-642-1234. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Aaron Clark, food blogger, cookbook author. We're talking about freezer meals. She's got a couple recipes for things to freeze, store, and reheat shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Author of the cookbook, The Well-Plated Cookbook. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Keith is with us in Green Bay. Keith, hi.
Hello. My summer hobby is gardening. So I tend to put a lot of my garden produce in the freezer. But rather than making complete meals, I will freeze my garden produce in square Tupperware containers in more like serving size portions. Once it's frozen, then I can throw it in my air sucker bag and have component parts in my freezers stacked up in bricks.
Ooh, what kind of components are your favorites to work with, Keith?
Oh, things like frozen corn and frozen beans that I've grown myself. I have my own tomato sauces. A lot of it's in jars, but I like to have some of it frozen. Things of that sort. And if it's in a square brick, it takes up less room in the freezer than if it's in sour cream containers. Those little round things. You know, they do take up space, but if you do them square, they take up less space.
I love it.
And since I'm alone now, I used to do pans of lasagna, but if you've got like a dozen bricks of lasagna in the freezer, it gets a little boring. This way I can make a small amount of something, or I can have the components ready to go. You know, I can take a brick of green beans and a brick of corn and frozen tomato sauce and some chicken stock and whatever. And I can make my winter minestrone out of component parts. And it tastes fresher to me than having it all made up already.
That sounds great, Keith. I love that idea. And Aaron, you mentioned the idea of freezing is to, you know, get stuff when it's fresh and freeze it. It's right out of his garden there and then ready to rock whenever he wants it.
I want to come raid your freezer, Keith. That sounds like the freezer of my dreams right there.
Yeah. And Keith mentioned lasagna. I think along with quiche, that's another classic. Make a goodly amount of it and then freeze some of it. Do you have a favorite lasagna bit of advice, Aaron, for freezing?
That, I think a great point that Keith actually made was I had some, when I was single, I made myself an entire lasagna, and I don't think I could eat lasagna for about a year after I finished it. So either, you know, just being realistic about how much you're going to eat. And, you know, if you do make a whole lasagna and you know that you're not going to get to all 12 bricks of it that are in your freezer, it's also okay to share with people to give it away. A nice thing about lasagna is that it is really easy to slice and portion, and you can actually bake it directly from frozen, provided that you use a freezer-safe dish. And then I like to put the lasagna in the oven while it is preheating so that it can, you know, start to thaw as the oven comes to temperature. And casseroles work really nicely that way too.
Keith, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Dawn in Dodgeville. Dawn, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I love using the freezer, particularly for portion control, because it's just my husband and I. And so one of our favorite things to make is a huge pot of chili. And chili is one of those foods that taste better the second time around than when you originally make it. And we also love to have dessert. So I bake a lot of desserts, and I cut them up into individual portion sizes, label them, put them in the freezer.
Oh.
Every night when we finish our dinner, then I say, okay, what would you like for dessert tonight? And my husband makes a choice. And then I immediately take it out and just set it out. And it's about an hour and a half or 2 hours later that we actually have our dessert with a cup of coffee. And by then, it's defrosted and it's wonderful.
And you don't have the whole pan sitting there, so you don't think, I'll just have one more piece.
Oh, exactly. It makes it just, and we are also RVers and we have a motorhome.
Oh.
And so this is just a very easy way to say, okay, what dessert should we take with us? And breakfast casseroles. I make 9 by 13 pans of breakfast casseroles, cut them up into 8 or 12 pieces, freeze them. And okay, what would you like to have for breakfast on this camping trip?
Fantastic. Dawn, you gave us a lot to work with. Dawn's a big freezer fan. I want to key in on one word she said there, Aaron, because the word was chili. And you have shared, we've got a link at WPR.org/Food Friday to your, it was a white chicken chili. Can you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm. Chili is one of my favorite foods to freeze as well. To Dawn's point, it really does. Maybe there is an exception to things will get better in the freezer. I think chili might be the one exception to that rule. And something that I love about it is that no two chilies are alike, and there's a chili for every mood and season. So as much as I love like a hearty tomato-based chili, the recipe that I have shared with WPR is a white chicken chili. It is a little bit lighter, very freezer friendly, and you can make it in the stovetop or the crock pot. I think that chili should be very thick. As my husband would say, if I can't stand my spoon up in it, then it's not really chili. The trick that I use for this one is it has white beans in it, and you puree it just a little bit, and the beans help to make it really thick and rich.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Again, you can find a link at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday with a focus on freezer meals. Aaron Clark is with us, author of the well-plated cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Back to your calls now. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. Several things. My husband and I are vegetarians, so we don't deal with meat and fish. And I wanted to... I would appreciate it that you raised the question of freezing raw eggs, because we have backyard chickens, and when we have a super abundance of eggs, we just freeze them, and they keep for years. And we've used them when we've had a paucity of eggs. We have a huge garden. We do lots of lasagna and freezing of vegetables. But the main thing that I wanted to raise is that we have several chest freezers that are not frost-free. And if you are using the freezing compartment of your refrigerator in your kitchen, it's almost certainly going to be a frost-free refrigerator, which means it goes through a freezer. It goes through freezing and then thawing cycles to get rid of the frost. And foods will not keep as well in a freezer like that. So what we do is we either use freezer containers that are squared shape blocks that are blocks, or we use vacuum sealing. And foods in our chest freezers that do not, they just stay cold all the time. They don't go through that thawing cycle. Foods keep for years. we've dug out, you know, 4 or 5 year old. What we do is we defrost the freezer once or twice a year, and then we can reorganize it and discover things that have gotten lost. And
gotcha, and, Stella. We don't have too much time left, but thanks for sharing that and a little freezer technology there too. Aaron, you're big on freezing. Have you gone into having that that second freezer, whether a chest freezer or otherwise?
We haven't, and then I can't even tell you how many times I am trying to, again, Tetris my freezer at home and wishing that I had one. So I think that is maybe going to be on my birthday list this year, as exciting of a birthday present as that would be.
Thanks again for that call. Aaron, what kind of freezer projects, cooking projects do you have in mind for this weekend, maybe with the freezer in mind?
You know, I just, with this chilly weather, I have been so in the mood for comfort food, and I have not had chicken pot pie for a while. That is another really freezer-friendly recipe. So I think I'm going to make a double batch of that, one for us to enjoy for dinner, and then I'm going to pop the other in my freezer for a snowy day to come.
And then you make your own crusts on those, did you mention earlier?
I do. I mean, I will say there is no shame in a store-bought pie crust. You know, we are only human. You know, you don't have to be a hero all the time. If someone does want a pie crust recipe, I have a pretty foolproof one on my website, wellplated.com.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great being here. Thank you.
Been talking to Aaron Clark, creator of wellplated.com and author of the Well Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. She joined us for this week's edition of Food Friday. We've been talking about recipes and strategies for freezing and reheating great meals. We've got recipes from Aaron for you. You can find the full recipe for Aaron's freezer breakfast sandwiches. This one, I think I got to try sometime. Find the full recipe there. And then there's links to that white chicken chili we talked about. Oh, and we had so many calls, we didn't get to a third recipe. I love squash. Crockpot butternut squash soup. This one's going to freeze up real good as well. You can find them all on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. And hey, still time for you to share your freezer food favorites with as much alliteration as you want. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you like to cook and keep in your freezer and when you like to use it. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some people at elder care facilities can face the risk of eviction. Find out why and what they and their families can do about it. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Want to take a minute to say a sad but fond farewell to longtime Ideas Network producer Bill Martins. Bill worked, I worked with him on the Joy Cardine show back in the day for a bunch of years. He came over to Central Time. That's where he's been working for the last bunch of years. He's moving on to a new media adventure now. First, Bill, good luck to you in the new job. We've said it off the air. I'm saying it on the air too. And if you're listening, you may have heard Bill's voice on the air. He's been on this show from time to time. You may have heard him during member drives. You might have heard his voice. I promise you, you've heard the fruits of his labor. He's found so many of the guests we've talked to over the many years he's been here, many of the great ideas. He's just contributed so much to the morning and afternoon sound here on the Ideas Network. Bill Martins, good luck. Again, thanks for all the great work here on the Ideas Network. We're really going to miss you. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Wisconsin's first election of 2022 is just around the corner. The last day of voting for the Milwaukee mayoral primary is February 15th. It's one of the nonpartisan primaries going on around the state. Early voting in the primary, which includes 7 candidates, all hoping to replace former Mayor Tom Barrett, is already underway. The top 2 candidates would advance to the April 5th special election. At WPR.org/centraltime, we've linked to the WPR landing page for all of our coverage of the mayor's race. That includes conversations Kate Archer-Kent is having with the candidates on The Morning Show. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Wherever you are, what are your questions about the run for mayor in Milwaukee? Your thoughts on it? If you're in Milwaukee yourself, What do you want from a new mayor? What issue do you want to see them focusing on? What do you want to hear them talking about? What should be their priority for day one on the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Larry Sadler is a journalist who's covered Milwaukee for the better part of four decades, including 30 years at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's written on a range of topics, including city and county government, politics, and transportation. His latest piece for Milwaukee Magazine is called What to Watch For in the Milwaukee Mayoral Primary. Larry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a rare thing in Milwaukee, historically speaking. It's pretty rare that there's not an incumbent mayor in races there. How uncommon is this?
This is only the fourth time in 62 years, Rob, that we have had an election for mayor without an incumbent on the ballot. Milwaukee tends to reelect incumbents very frequently. And so as a result, we have had only seven mayors, elected mayors of Milwaukee in the last century.
Wow. And there was some question about when this election was going to happen. It is, in fact, in this this primary season now. But depending on former Mayor Barrett's confirmation as U.S. Ambassador to Luxembourg, this could have been, what, as late as this fall?
It easily could have been. And some people thought that there might even have been some maneuvering on the part of Senate Democrats to do that, so that it would increase turnout in the fall election in Milwaukee, which is a very blue city, and therefore perhaps influence the Senate election of U.S. Senate election of Ron Johnson. That did not happen. And coincidentally, it was not too long after I wrote about that, that the Senate did, in fact, confirm Barrett right in time to get on the ballot for this spring election, which ordinarily would have been just county board and judicial races.
And you mentioned turnout. Does a Milwaukee mayor race tend to bring a lot of people out, so in the primary and then in the general?
Well, we have not had this exact situation of an election for mayor with no incumbent on the ballot and no other major race on the ballot since the 1940s. So it is very hard to predict exactly what the turnout is going to be.
Fair enough.
in the previous two elections, let me back up a bit. In 1960 and 1988, there were open races for mayor, but there were also races for county exec. In those races, it was around 21-23%. In 2004, when Mayor Barrett was elected, it was a 10-way primary, but it was the same day as the presidential primary. Turnout was up then about 40%. This time, really hard to say. It could be in the 20s. It could be as high as 30%. That's the unofficial prediction from the City Election Commission executive director.
And you've been looking at another piece of math, the number seven, which is how many candidates are going to be on the ballot. It's going to get narrowed down to two. But seven means, depending on how it gets sliced up, somebody could end up on the final ballot without actually winning a whole ton of votes.
Absolutely true. And now, historically, that has not happened. In most prior elections, the second place finisher has had at least 30%. But, you know, with seven candidates on the ballot, you could have a lot fewer. You could have as few as, you know, 15%. And possibly be the second place finisher.
We are talking about the race for mayor in Milwaukee, a rare race for mayor in Milwaukee without an incumbent on the ballot. We are talking to Larry Sadler, longtime journalist in Milwaukee. He's got a piece in Milwaukee Magazine previewing the mayoral primary. You can meet the candidates with interviews on the morning show, listen live, and find them archived online over at WPR.org. And now you can join in with your thoughts on this race, your questions about it, 800-642-1234, wherever you are, What are you watching for when you look at Milwaukee and its next mayor? If you live in Milwaukee itself, love to hear from you. What is on your mind as you approach this election? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's, Larry, take a whirlwind tour of our seven candidates here. If you can give us a little capsule of each of them, starting with, and we don't have a mayor. We've got an acting mayor, the head of the city council, a Cavalier Johnson.
Yeah, so he is one of the youngest people on the ballot, maybe the youngest in this particular race, and I believe one of the youngest ever to be mayor. He is just 35 years old. He has been on the council for 6 years, two of them as council president. Prior to that, he was an aide to Mayor Barrett, working on community relations and workforce development. The next we would have State Senator Taylor, mm-hmm. Lena Taylor. She has been in office now since 2004 in the Senate after 1 year in the Assembly. She is a well-known figure in Milwaukee politics. In addition to her time in the legislature, she ran for county executive in 2008 and also ran for mayor in 2020. Obviously didn't win either of those times. And she would be the first Black woman to be mayor, just as she is the second Black woman to be a state senator. Cavalier Johnson would be the first Black man to be mayor in his own right, as opposed to acting mayor. Then we have Sheriff Ernell Lucas. He is a career law enforcement officer. He was a member of the Milwaukee Police Department for, I believe, 25 years, starting as a patrol officer, rising to the rank of captain. He did survive a shooting on duty. Came back from that, as I said, rose to captain, and he then left the police department and became a security official for Major League Baseball. Came back from that job to run for sheriff in 2018, and so he is finishing up his first term as sheriff. No indication whether he would plan to run for re-election if he loses this race. Let's see. Then we have Alderwoman Marina Dmitrievich. She has been on the council for only 2 years, but before that, she was on the county board for 16 years. The youngest person ever elected to the county board. I believe she was just 22 or 23 at the time. She also served as county board chair and was the second woman and the youngest person to serve as county board chair. And then among the top five, we also have, not last but not least, Alderman Bob Donovan, former Alderman Bob Donovan, who was on the council for 20 years, ending in 2020. He ran for mayor in 2016, lost to Tom Barrett, as Senator Taylor did. And he is, you know, certainly the most conservative in the race, having had a strong law and order stand and also dedicated opposition to the Milwaukee streetcar, the HOP.
And then there are two, I think it's fair to say, lesser known candidates or lower profile candidates, a businessman, Michael Sampson, and community activist Aisha Griffin.
That is correct. Sampson is an events planner. He has an events planning company. Aisha Griffin was actually better known a few years ago. She ran for, I think, five or six offices, including mayor and county exec. First came to prominence as a state assembly candidate. She was running as an independent and tried to get on the ballot with a slogan that I don't think I can say on public radio. But she lost both the battle to get the slogan on the ballot, and she lost all of her races. She's never gotten more than 1,500 or so votes for anything.
We're talking to longtime Milwaukee journalist Larry Sandler, looking at the candidates and some of the biggest issues in the Milwaukee mayoral primary. Now underway, early voting, last day of voting on February 15th, the primary election day itself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issues do you want to hear candidates from Milwaukee mayor focusing on, whether you're looking in from the outside or you live or have lived recently in Milwaukee? What are the most important issues? What do you think the city needs from a new mayor? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Larry Sandler, journalist who's covered Milwaukee city and county government, politics, and transportation for over 30 years, 30 of those years with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking about the race for mayor there. The primary's coming up, seven candidates on the ballot to replace former mayor Tom Barrett, who resigned to take an ambassador position in Luxembourg. You can join in with your thoughts on the candidates, the issues, or with your questions about the race at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi. I worked for 15 plus years within the government structure of Milwaukee. I grew up actually in central Wisconsin and moved to Milwaukee and had sort of a culture shock and realized that how the attitudes of the rest of the state and it affected how the government funding toward the city is so lacking.
Chris, thanks for the call. Larry, that's been a concern raised recently, and I think in the past, concerns about state government shared revenue going to Milwaukee, support, a feeling of us against them with Milwaukee sometimes. Do you see that as something people are talking about there?
Yeah, and it comes out not so much in the way that the caller said, but it comes out in the results that the city doesn't have the kind of resources that it wants to deal with all of its problems. And so particularly now that the city is facing some serious pension funding issues that are going to be affecting its budget in the next few years, that's going to be more and more of an issue. They got a brief reprieve from that thanks to the federal aid that all local governments received. But, you know, that's not going to last forever. And they will have to deal with it. There have been a number of debates about how to deal with it. You know, certainly for many years, the city officials and county officials had pushed to get more shared revenue. They didn't get anywhere on that, and the share of shared revenue remained stagnant. They have been pushing more recently to get more revenue options in terms of perhaps a local sales tax. That also has not gone anywhere in the Republican-controlled legislature, even though Governor Evers was supportive of it.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Todd in Milwaukee. Todd, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Todd?
I had a question. Just wanted to ask if any campaign, a write-in campaign, has ever been effective in the Milwaukee mayor race?
Oh, Todd, interesting question. Larry, write-in campaigns tend to be real long shots. Have you encountered any prominent ones in the race for Milwaukee mayor?
No. And in fact, even candidates who are on the ballot, you know, if they're not well-known politicians with, you know, sizable campaign treasuries, they tend not to do very well. And so, you know, for a mayor's race, you're not going to succeed as a write-in. Certainly at a district level race, I have seen people win write-in campaigns. You know, that's a whole different story.
Todd, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Larry Sandler, journalist in the Milwaukee area. He wrote recently about Milwaukee's mayoral primary in Milwaukee Magazine. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Wanted to get into a couple issues. The funding there is one of them, Larry. I know Milwaukee is one of many communities around the country that have seen a rise in violence, gun homicides in particular, in the last couple of years. What kind of things are candidates saying about gun violence and public safety?
Well, there's a real range of approaches that the candidates are taking here. Bob Donovan has made his career as a law and order conservative and frequently with support from the police union, although I don't believe they've endorsed yet in this campaign. He wants to see more police officers on the street. And he takes generally a fairly enforcement-oriented approach, although he does talk about the need for community policing. By contrast, some of the other candidates are taking more of an approach of alternative measures and talking about the need to have more mental health professionals, for example, dealing with people rather than necessarily sending police to every call. Cavalier Johnson has introduced a plan that really covers both approaches. And so he's more diverse in his approach. I think, but he's not talking about increasing the police department. He's talking about maintaining the strength that they have. And some of the other candidates do talk about maintaining the strength of the police department, but also talk about getting at kind of the root causes of crime and addressing social issues.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Oak Creek. Steve, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Steve?
Milwaukee County Parks. We're having a problem at Bender Park with getting that dredged. Milwaukee County Parks is claiming they have no money to do that. How does they get involved with giving them more money in order to take care of the Milwaukee County Parks, not just including Bender, but all the Milwaukee County Parks?
Steve, thanks for the call. Now, it gets tricky, and I think people may blur these. That's the Milwaukee County system. This is the city of Milwaukee. Mayor's race, Larry, I don't know if you have thoughts on Steve's question, but I think sometimes those services may, the boundaries must get blurred in Milwaukee City and Milwaukee County.
Right, and as you say, that is not something that the city of Milwaukee candidates would get involved in. That is strictly a county issue. And in fact, the park that he referred to is in the suburb of Oak Creek. So it's not even within the city limits. It does get to the question that the earlier caller was talking about with shared revenue or alternate ways of raising revenue, because certainly the county does have a backlog of maintenance, deferred maintenance, and capital needs in its parks and other facilities.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Another issue I know you have your eye on, Larry, is economic development for the city's future. What kind of things are candidates talking about there?
So there also are a range of proposals. One thing that comes up in every mayoral campaign is people talking about the need to have development in the neighborhoods versus downtown. And everybody says this. It seems to be harder to do than to talk about. Certainly Mayor Norquist and Mayor Barrett and talked about it, and they had some successes. But there's always a feeling that the downtown gets more than the neighborhoods. So again, you have candidates here. All of the candidates are saying they support neighborhood development as well as downtown development. There are some interesting ideas. Senator Taylor is talking about urban agriculture as an industry that should be nurtured to spur development in downtown throughout Milwaukee. Bob Donovan is talking about manufacturing tiny houses as something that could not only be a way of attracting development and jobs, but also dealing with the problem of homelessness. Alderman Dmitrievich talks about childcare as a way of supporting the workforce and approaching the the economic issues that way. So there's a whole range of ideas about how to deal with it.
I won't ask you to predict outcomes here, Larry, of course, but what kind of things are you watching for that you think may swing this primary toward one, well, I guess toward two candidates or somebody else?
Well, two things to look for, obviously, are how they're doing in the polls and how they're doing in terms of finances. And there, Cavalier Johnson is in the lead in both cases. The one independent poll had him at 25%. He has more than $350,000 in the bank, which is more than anybody else. And he has the support of former county executive Abley, who is capable of spending a great deal of money in both independently, and he's already given the maximum contribution to Johnson. Sheriff Lucas and Alderman Dmitrievich have healthy campaign treasuries of more than $100,000. Donovan is in the $60,000 range. Senator Taylor got into the race late and did not have to file a campaign finance statement.
And that's all the time we have. Sorry, Larry Sadler is a journalist in Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the mayoral primary in Wisconsin's biggest city. Coming up after the news, we'll learn about the history of hobbies and how they function in our daily lives and in our society. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.